So here's what I want to do in the course of this evening before we get to our Q&A later on. I want to begin by describing for you what I believe is the essence of the crisis and help you to understand why we even titled the event like this. Then I want to offer you briefly what I think are some wrong responses to this crisis, some of the ways that we instinctively react to it that I think are really cul-de-sacs and don't really get us anywhere. And then I want to bring in what I think is the essence of the Christian response. And of course, there's a great deal that we could say on this, but the way in which the Christian faith speaks uniquely into the crisis of masculinity as it strikes us these days. So let me begin then by laying out for you what I see as the crisis that we are dealing with. And this is really the heart of our disagreement, isn't it? There are some who believe that the problem, the nature of the crisis, is that men are not masculine enough. And there are some who believe that the crisis is men, in the sense that men are to blame, men are the problem. There's an artist called Grayson Perry who said that all the world's problems can be boiled down to one thing, the behavior of people with a Y chromosome. And given that he is a man, I assume he is including himself in that category. Nina Perry, who has just this year released, she's a philosopher and a journalist, and she recently released a book, What Do Men Want?, which is just a pleasure to read. I'll quote her a couple of times tonight. But she sums up the anger at men in the culture at large. It's not the view that she believes herself, but she sums it up like this. She says, the internet and the consumerism that surrounds and is supported by it has in recent years been full of admonitions against this thing that is called patriarchy, or more often, the patriarchy. There are tote bags available with slogans such as, hex the patriarchy, grab them by the patriarchy. My favorite season is the fall of the patriarchy. Fuck the patriarchy. Smash the patriarchy. Trample patriarchy with a unicorn standing on a skull. RIP patriarchy. Not today patriarchy. Less patriarchy, more cupcakes. Smashing the patriarchy is my cardio. The patriarchy isn't going to fight itself. Pizza, not patriarchy. And so on. She says the patriarchy is then unambiguously a bad thing, according to many tote bags. And so we're obviously bringing into this preconceptions, but for me, if I could just distill and summarize what I think the problem is, and we're trying to define something of the crisis here, is that I believe men often feel a degree of a sense of being lost and directionless in the modern age, somewhat adrift, often deeply uncertain of their place and their purpose in the world as it's currently configured, and vaguely guilty as well for a kind of intuitive resonance with a desire to be more manly in some way or to exhibit masculinity or manhood, and feeling that is somehow wrong. And it's proved by, and what I want to just substantiate this with is a number of, just to try and fill out what I think is something of the crisis, I want to offer you some external markers or evidences of the crisis, and then some internal ones that kind of emerge from the heart of men. And the external ones are these. They're to do with work, education, and family. And I'm just going to load in some stats at the front end of this talk, so please bear with me, but I'll try and move fairly briskly. Let's begin with work. It may surprise you to know that, particularly in the Western world, the economy has tipped in favor of women and has done so in the UK since 2010, in the US since 2009. So the global average unemployment for men in their 20s and 30s has moved from 2% in the early 1970s or 1970 itself to 9% in 2012, which is a shocking thing, isn't it? Just to imagine the many millions of people globally who now find men who find themselves unemployed. While us, on the other hand, and there's no animosity in me saying this, and I'm not in any way saying this with a critical lens, but women are doing incredibly well. So Hannah Rosin, the US journalist, wrote the book The End of Men, subtitled And the Rise of Women, which is also just a really enjoyable, rip-roaring read. She said that In the US, the economy is becoming a kind of traveling sisterhood. Professional women leave home and enter the workforce, creating domestic jobs for other women to fill. And our vast and struggling middle class, where the disparities between men and women are the greatest, is slowly turning into a matriarchy, with men increasingly absent from the workforce and from home, and women making all the decisions. And of course, when you read or you hear me recite to you a paragraph like that one, it strikes you as a very strange claim to make, doesn't it, given what we often hear in the media and the way that it's very much portrayed in the opposite direction. But why has this shift taken place? And one of the biggest reasons has to do with the way that the working world has changed in the industrialized and post-industrial Western world. So Hannah Rosen puts it like this. She said, in the past, men derived their advantage largely from size and strength, but the post-industrial economy is indifferent to brawn. It doesn't matter how big and strong you are, it doesn't count anymore in terms of succeeding in the workforce. And so she cites, there's a whole chapter given just as a kind of case study to the change that's taken place within pharmacists. Once upon a time, almost 100% of pharmacists were male, and they were keen to keep it that way. But it was a very physical job. They had to lug great big sacks of chemicals into their place of work and then grind out these products and form them into these medicines, which were then dealt over the counter to their patients. And of course, over time, that whole process became mechanized and automated. And what then became prized were the people skills, dealing with difficult and awkward patients. And what has then consequently happened is a whole-scale shift from an almost exclusively male profession to a massively, overwhelmingly female profession. And Hannah Rosen uses that as a case study of the way that it can be extrapolated out across Western economies and all of the kind of service sectors in which we work. And that may or may not reflect your particular workplace, but I'm trying to paint you a broad picture here, so regardless of what may be true in your own office. She says that's obviously with the exception of the most dangerous jobs. And if you read authors like Nina Power or Hannah Rosen on the subject, they will be very swift to confirm that the most dangerous jobs are still occupied by men, which is why it's almost always men who die from work-related accidents. So the working world has changed. Then there's education, and the evidence is clear that girls are outperforming boys at every level of education, from the youngest years right the way through to higher education, and often in an extraordinary way. So in a book by Zimbardo and Coulomb, who wrote the book Man Disconnected, they showed a graph of the trends of higher education from around the 60s or 70s all the way through to the early 2000s. And the percentage of men in relation to women in higher education. And there was a point, it's an X-shaped graph, there was a point in 1981 when universities or colleges, as they're called in the US, were even, 50% ratio men to women. But we have long gone past that, so that now 61% of those in higher education are women and only 39% are men. And they conclude this, they say it's not a question of IQ. Young men are just not putting in the effort. And it translates into a lack of career options. So we're looking at a world in which the workforce is increasingly seeing men drained from it, in which men are not achieving the qualifications which will then allow them to earn a decent living in a competitive environment. And then in an issue that I think is particularly close to my heart, we can talk about family. There was a time, obviously, in history, not so long back, almost within living memory, when we were more based around communities and lived and grew up and worked in the places in which we were born. And therefore, boys grew up in homes where they were connected with a wide, extensive network of relatives and uncles and brothers and fathers, and there'd be multiple children in the home. And that has changed drastically. The average UK household now contains 2.4 people. Not that any given household has 0.4 of a person. You understand how these averages work, right? But on average, there are 2.4 people in a UK household, which shows you how the nuclear home has shrunk down to almost the smallest possible unit that can exist as a household. And divorce in the UK affects 48% of children by the age that they are 16. 48% of kids. And I find that this heartbreaking statistic. And obviously, when you begin to think about these issues in the way that the family has been disrupted, the obvious rebuttal is, well, that's going to affect boys and girls equally, isn't it? Since boys and girls both exist in these families that are smaller, where divorce is taking place and so on. But of course, that isn't quite how things pan out, is it? Partly because, of course, most kids from divorced homes end up being taken care of by the mother with absent fathers or fathers they rarely see, and certainly not on a day-to-day basis. But there's also just a uniquely male issue for boys, that a way in which they're affected by this. Michael Gurion, a social philosopher, said, he was affirming the mother's role, but he said this, he says, there's not one single thing a mother can do to help her sons in adolescence, to calm down and to be moral. Boys need a father. And why? Because that's how nature's set up, because it's human nature. I don't know whether he's writing or thinking from a faith perspective, but I certainly resonate with that and recognize that that is an absolutely accurate assessment of the issue for boys. There's an African proverb which says that if we do not initiate the boys, then they will burn the village down. And so when you're asking the question, why is it that the prison population is overwhelmingly male? Why is it that violent crimes are overwhelmingly perpetrated by men? I think a lot of it can be traced back to the problems that exist in childhood with fatherlessness and the breakdown of the family and the way that that then has these dire consequences for boys. I'm sure it affects women in all kinds of ways as well, but obviously the effects seem to be more catastrophic for boys. Not always, and some of you may well have grown up in that kind of a context yourself. Many of you will have, I'm certain. Sebastian Junger, who wrote Tribe, a very provocative little book, he asked the question, why is it that boys are dying by violence and accidents at many times the rate of girls? And he said, these deaths can be thought of as one generation after another trying to run their own initiation rites because they live in a society that no longer does that for them. In other words, he's putting his finger on an issue that is now so prevalent as to be almost an endemic in a society, that boys are not taught how to be men by men, and therefore act in perpetual boyhood for the rest of their lives, often in these deeply emotionally unregulated ways that I've been describing. And so there are all these external realities that are affecting men that are part of this crisis. But to bring it more close to home, there is, of course, also the internal problem that men are wrestling with, the evidences or the markers of male demise. And I want to mention here suicide, despair, and oblivion. Now, we are used to hearing in the media very frequently the language of toxic masculinity, and Jeremy brought it up even in the introduction here. And I want to come back to that later. But I think that there's an equal and opposite problem, which is the general malaise among men. It's almost the very opposite problem of toxic masculinity. It's an apathy and a checking out. There was an eccentric US poet called Robert Bly who founded the mythopoetic movement for men, trying to reestablish manhood in some strange ways with strange rituals. But he said this when he's traveling and encountering men on his tours of reading his poetry and so on. He said increasingly he was meeting what he called the soft male. He said, they're lovely, valuable people. I like them. And they're not interested in harming the earth or starting wars or working for corporations, but something's wrong. Many of these men are unhappy. There's not much energy in them. This is quoted by Nina Power in her book, which is really a lament for men. And some of these evidences I've just mentioned are these. One is the rates of suicide. In the UK, it is the case that suicide is the biggest killer of men under the age of 45. 75% of suicides are male. So that you could say it is overwhelmingly a male problem. And in 2019, there were 4,900 men who took their own lives in that year alone. The great question is why? What is it that's bringing about this deep bleakness and despair in the lives of men? And alongside suicide, there is, as I've already mentioned, this generic despair, which is so often something that men identify with and understand and resonate with, and I suspect has brought a number of you here this evening. There's an author who goes by the handle of Zero H.P. Lovecraft. But anyway, he said, the component of male lived experience that is wholly inaccessible to women, more than any other, is the colossal and abyssal apathy of the universe towards you. So he's saying that what men seem to struggle with uniquely in this deep existential way is this sense of isolation in an empty, cold universe in which the universe is totally uncaring towards you. And that seems to be a thought that troubles men in a way that it doesn't quite trouble women. Now, I don't know if that's true or not, but in the book in which it was quoted, the female author was saying, that seems to me to be true from my own experience and talks with other women. And then I mentioned also oblivion. And what I mean here is that men seem to have the capacity to lose themselves in all-consuming, life-consuming and life-destroying vices. And, you know, you could list them off in your own mind, and it's true, isn't it? Just anecdotally, from you think about the people you know who is most likely to self-destruct in terrible habits, it's nearly always men. But two of the ones which are affecting just the general populace, and we're not talking about extremes here, we're talking about the general population of men, are men losing their lives in gaming. I don't have a problem with computer games. I was a bit of an expert at Call of Duty myself at one stage. But apparently, Jane McGonigal calculated that by the age of 21, the average young person has spent 10,000 hours playing computer games. You know Malcolm Gladwell's unit of mastery. So you've gained mastery. And it takes only 4,800 hours to gain a bachelor's degree. So you imagine how much of your life has been sunk into this. And then the negative consequences that spiral out from that, so that we should no longer be surprised that so many young men find themselves unable to enter the workforce, living in their parents' home, and just really not contributing to society. And all of it stems back to a childhood just lost in this world of not learning and giving themselves to this wasted time. And perhaps more damagingly even than that is the prevalence of pornography. I know that it is not fashionable in our day and age to take a moralistic stance on pornography. And it's certainly often the source of humor in all kinds of sitcoms and so on. But the reality is that it has a profoundly destructive effect on the people who use it. And so Zimbardo and Coulomb, who co-authored the book on Man Disconnected, a male and female author, they said, the young men we've spoken with who demonstrated signs of arousal addiction, which is their term for the kind of the hedonistic treadmill of wanting a new and novel experiences online that make you dull to any joy, especially sexual joy in the real world. She said, the men who demonstrate signs of arousal addiction feel very anxious in social situations in general, have less motivation to set and complete goals, feel out of control, and even discussed suicide. So far from the prevalent narrative that this stuff does us no harm, and maybe a bit of fun, and may even spice up your own sex life, it seems to be that rather what it does is it pulls people into this state of isolation and depression and feeling useless and feeling out of control of your life, lacking motivation, unable to offer a positive, vigorous contribution to the world, unable to lead. And of course, I know that pornography is not an exclusively male issue. I understand that. But it seems to me to hook men more deeply and in a more damaging way, and therefore leads to all these negative consequences in their lives. And so, look, I've just tried to paint you a very broad, rapid picture of the issue as I see it. The external issues, work, education, family, the internal ones, suicide, despair, oblivion. And the way that this is affecting us in almost, as a hidden disease, but something which is right under our noses. So that this is where I wanted to bring this section to a point. In many ways, the world is a better and safer and more prosperous place. There's no question of that, with more equality and the things that seem to make life better for many people. But something is going wrong with many, many men, especially. And the analogy, the image that often comes to my mind when I consider this malaise is to think about those times, those occasions when I visited the zoo. And whenever you go to a zoo and you look through the cage or through the perspex at magnificent creatures, whether they be enormous eagles or giant big cats or whatever else it is, you see these creatures and they fear for nothing. They never have to worry about where the next meal is going to come from. They are as prosperous as an animal can be, but no one will ever imagine that they are flourishing, or that this is the life that they were meant to live. And it seems to me that something like that sort of captures the essence of the age in which we live, that in so many ways life is better than it's ever been, and yet we're doing worse as a result. I don't want to pretend I have simple answers to this, but I want us to at least acknowledge the problem. And neither should we be surprised. You think about this. For thousands of years, in every society on the face of the world, men were raised from early boyhood to understand that unless they made a positive contribution, unless they grew in strength and skill and craftsmanship or whatever else it was they had to hone, then they would starve. And they had to therefore assume responsibility in order to take care of those who were under their care, or else they would literally die. And therefore they needed to express what we sometimes describe or think of as masculine traits, or I know that's a controversial way to describe it, but we think things like aggression, or leadership, or determination, or courage, or strength. Please don't mishear me. I'm not saying that women don't exhibit these things. But they had to. It was necessity for men to exhibit these things. And now, by and large, these things are either not needed or they're regarded as actively dangerous. And then we wonder why it is that men don't seem to be able to adjust or to switch off the impulses and instincts that have been sort of hardwired in over thousands of years of culture and society and survival. And these are questions that I think will trouble all of us if we give it enough thought. Hannah Rosin offers many proofs that this is almost exactly what's happening. She says, women are more plastic. She's not talking about enhancements or anything like that. She says that they're more plastic in the sense that they are malleable and moldable. Women more easily have adapted and adjusted to the modern age. And she cites, for example, the BEM test, BEM test, which measures personality traits. And she says that over recent decades, the last 30 or 40 years, as women have been tested in successive cohorts, one of the things that you've seen is the way in which women have increasingly exhibited and displayed more so-called masculine traits. But she says the reverse is not true. Men, if she describes women as plastic, she describes men as cardboard. They are unable to change. And whatever the psychology or whatever the hardwiring, biology, whatever it is, who knows what the reason is, men seem to be unable to make the adjustments necessary in order to accommodate the shifts that are taking place in our world where women are going out to work and men are then expected to stay at home or so on. And therefore, there is this, and also the changes I've described to you in the economy and so on, and the nature of the work itself. So these are the problems that I see around us, and I feel like I could go on a great deal longer describing more of these problems, but I want to just leave it there for now. I told you I was going to address some of the wrong responses, and I just want to do this very briefly before I come to what I think are some of the answers. Here's one wrong response. Denying or ignoring the issue. The vast majority of messages that I think we hear in media, advertising, social media, and so on, is a relentless message about the damaging effects of masculinity and the way in which men are to blame and are the problem. And so, for example, I remember not so long back the way that the gender pay gap was just all over the news for seemingly for weeks on end, wasn't it? When certain statistics came to light around the most highly paid executives and the BBC and so on. And of course, these are issues that are difficult but have multiple sides to the issue, and I don't think it's as simple as often the media portray it. But the problem in fixating as we do on the negative sides of men and what they are, the way that they perpetrate evil, is that then we miss the problem under our noses of men suffering and the way that they are struggling or the way that they're failing to adjust in the modern age. And so denying or ignoring the issue, I think, is a wrong step. I think we have to confront it, acknowledge it, seek to understand what's going on. Another thing that I think is a wrong move is to simply, as so many do, to retreat into the kind of acceptable view that there are no differences anyway between men and women. And because that's the acceptable view, you can't even raise the problem of male problems, because if men and women are interchangeable and the same, then there are no male problems, are there? They're just human problems, and there's no crisis of masculinity. And many have pushed hard in trying to do away with any distinction between male and female in terms of our characteristics, our hardwiring, the way we are, describing these things as social constructs, that masculinity is a social construct, that femininity is a social construct. It's something that's invented by society, and therefore we can just as easily uninvent it and try to come up with this sort of androgynous, gender-neutral society. I have a problem with that because I think the idea of a gender-neutral society is itself the ultimate social construct, because it is a new concept, isn't it? One that has only arisen in the last, what should we say, 50, 60, 70 years. But really, the reason why I struggle with this is because I think that when we're so often, it's only acceptable to think in terms of gender neutrality. It means that we have no way of dealing with exclusively or predominantly male problems. So think about this in terms of medical issues. I have a friend, twin sisters, who one of the sisters asked the other sister, very anxious one day, how she could go and get a screening for prostate cancer. And of course, women don't get prostate cancer. And somehow she had missed this fact and therefore was worrying about nothing. If you go to the doctor with abdominal issues or whatever issue in your body, one of the first things that doctor will want to ascertain is your sex. Are you male or are you female? Because the diagnosis to your issue may be radically different depending on whether you are a man or a woman. And if that's true in our biology, then I think as an analogy, that can also extend to what I'm describing as more issues of the soul, the interior person. That it's possible, if we can recognize that men and women have differences and have different desires or different maladies or different ways of suffering or different needs, then we can acknowledge that there are uniquely male problems and then begin to understand them and seek to address them. So I think one wrong move then is to do away with the differences between men and women. And another wrong move also, and I really do want to underline this because I think this is an important one, is to offer a kind of cheap, hollow masculinity as the answer to men's problems. So the internet is obviously full of, well, it's full of everything, isn't it? But it's full of options for men to engage in self-improvement of their lives that typically revolve around self-discipline, extreme self-discipline, stoicism, lifting heavy weights, making sure that you don't masturbate, making sure that you dress well and the rest of it. And this prescription is laid out for manhood that becomes more and more a kind of cartoonish version of manhood. So that, as one lady, Susan Faludi, describes it, men are encouraged to wear ornamental masculinity. You know, the urge to grow a beard, for example, just to demonstrate that you're, you know, something like that. So that these things are externalized, and it becomes that your masculinity becomes a kind of performance. And I don't think that particularly helps anyone. I'm not sure that it particularly gets us anywhere. And if anything, it just seems to make men the object of ridicule. And I don't think that's really helping the issue. And I want to bring you then back to what I think is the Christian response. I know I've left many things and questions open here, so let me try and give this some focus. I think that we're caught in a bind that seems almost impossible to untie, a paradox. That on the one hand, we can see and acknowledge that in broad trends, there are many, many men who are languishing in our sort of newly achieved gender-neutral society, or the journey towards gender neutrality. And therefore, there's no place for peculiarly male urges. So Phil Chrisman, who wrote an essay on this question of what it is that makes a man, he described what he found in himself as the abstract rage to protect, as a sort of uniquely male instinct or desire. And when I came across this in Nina Power's book, and when she was describing this and her own reaction to it, she said, to be in a heterosexual relationship as a woman is to understand perhaps something of the male desire to protect and the female desire to be protected. Not all women might feel like this, it's true, but I can't help but recognize this desire, at least partly, in myself. That's just one example of a kind of male instinct that we don't know how to deal with it in an age in which we're trying to move towards androgyny and the kind of removal of differences, and which, by the way, is very much, again, in contradiction with the transgender movement that wants to, again, enhance the differences by opting for the kind of performance of masculinity or femininity. But that's a question for another day. So on the one hand, men are languishing in the gender-neutral society, but on the other hand, wherever we then, you know, in response, people try to resurrect some version of manliness or masculinity or manhood, it all seems to go wrong very quickly. And this is where we end up, again, identifying and talking about the problem of toxic masculinity, where, you know, there's, which I would define like this. I'd say it's firstly the pressure to conform to a kind of two-dimensional version of what it means to be a man and then perform it to others, and the negative consequences that inevitably seem to fall out from that in terms of aggression, domineering, the violence at times, uncontrolled lust, and the need for sexual conquest, and emotional constipation, if I can put it like that, the inability or the unacceptability of men expressing their hearts and their emotions. So all kinds of, you know what I'm talking about, right? So whenever there's a kind of recovery, we need men to be men, it seems to go in that direction, which is just as unhelpful. So we're caught in this paradox. We don't know how to undo it. How can men find themselves in this day and age? And our culture, it seems to me, is incapable of dealing with this issue properly. When I was probably 20 years ago now, we got two kittens, a male and a female. And the boy kitten was just had the most wonderful, endearing personality, but he started to hump everything in sight. So we took him to the vets, we had his testicles chopped off, and overnight his personality changed. He became placid, disinterested, apathetic. It was a different cat altogether. And it seems to me that there's a sense in which we only have blunt instruments in our culture at large for dealing with the problem of men. That through manipulation or blame, it's a blunt instrument which seeks to kind of neuter men, but renders them in this kind of state that I've been describing of general kind of apathy or languishing or whatever else it is. And it reminded me of my cat. And it's not unlike, it seems to me that, again, that it's not unlike the old practice of giving lobotomies. You remember when people used to have mental health issues, they might go to a psychiatric hospital, and if other treatments didn't work, they resorted to cutting out portions of the brain. A brutal act. And have you ever seen the film One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest? You know, it could render you a dribbling mess of a person. Yeah, you don't have mental health issues anymore, but you're no use to society. And it seems to me that something like that, in the brute attacks against men, that it's almost like there's a lobotomy going on here, or like chemotherapy and the broad spectrum drugs that can damage so much along the way, not just killing the cancer, but also killing fertility or causing hair loss or whatever else it is. It seems to me that there's a kind of bluntness and a clumsiness to the way that we have approached this question of what is wrong with men. And it's actually caused a lot of damage along the way. Our culture seems to me to be incapable of dealing with it. And this is where I think that the Christian faith has something so penetrating and unique to say on this subject. And I want you to understand it through the lens of this phrase, toxic masculinity. Because what Christianity does and what Christ does is he's able to get into the middle of the problem and separate the toxic from the masculinity. And so there's a negative side to what Christianity says to men, and then a positive side. And the negative side is this. It begins by acknowledging. The Christian faith begins by acknowledging the almost limitless potential within men to perpetrate evil and wickedness. And we look out on our world at the moment at some of the most terrible things that are happening on the world stage, and surprise, surprise, who is behind it but autocratic male rulers, right? And that's just a glimpse at the newspapers for today. And you look at that story back through history, and we see that it's true. And the Bible is very explicit. It says, no one has done good, no, not one. That's the Bible's diagnostic of the human problem. It says there is a significant problem within the human heart. It is evil. But it does not say that the problem is masculinity. It says that the problem is sin. And therefore, it's not a blunt diagnosis that seems to capture just everything. It's a more penetrating, almost like a scalpel that comes in and gives a much more accurate and helpful diagnosis of the problem. And this is particularly evident in the teaching of Jesus. You know, I was reciting to you some of the characteristics of what our society has identified as toxicity within men, toxic masculinity. Listen to some of the words of Jesus. When he's addressing the male tendency, well, peculiarly, it seems to be the male tendency to want to dominate others. He said, you know that the rulers of the Gentiles, meaning the non-Jews, he said, lord it over them, and their great ones exercise authority over them. He said, it shall not be so among you. He didn't want that kind of culture within his church. He said, but whoever would be great among you must be your servant, and whoever would be first among you must be your slave. And he goes on to say, for even the Son of Man, which is his way of speaking of himself, came not to be served, but to serve, and to give his life as a ransom for many. So far from encouraging and puffing up men in their desire to dominate and to be alpha, Jesus says, no, the way up is the way down. I don't know anyone else in history who quite so explicitly called upon men especially to kill their desire to dominate others and to instead determine to be the servant of all, as he himself was for us. Or think about how he tackles the problem of male lust, which in our day and age seems to be almost unfettered without almost any barriers. I mean, who of us could have been shocked that the Me Too movement has arisen, given the fact that the 1960s and the sexual revolution basically offered men a free pass to do whatever they want with whoever they want, without responsibility? And then we're surprised that they took advantage of that opportunity and began trampling over women. But Jesus says, he said, you heard it was said, you shall not commit adultery, which was in the Old Testament law. But he said, but I say to you that everyone who looks at a woman with lustful intent has already committed adultery with her in his heart. And then he offers his own teaching. He uses these kind of graphic metaphors. He says, cut off your hand, gouge out your eye, be ruthless in putting to death inside you the desires which will cause you to harm others. So whether it's domineering, whether it's sexual abuse and the temptation within men toward conquest, or another example is male aggression. I know that the church has not had a 100% record on this one. And it is just a fact of life, a fact of Christian history, that Christians do not always live up to the teachings of Christ on any of these points. But I always want to point people back to Jesus. He said on aggression, he said, you've heard that it was said, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. It was a law that allowed you to have a balance in justice, that if someone harms you in a certain way, they would be harmed in exactly proportionate ways, so to stop escalation. But he took it further. He said, do not resist the one who is evil. But if anyone slaps you on the right cheek, turn to him the other also. And Jesus began to lay down the groundwork for a kind of an impulse that has existed within most Christians toward an antipathy towards violence and aggression as a means of solving any issues. And so, you know, it's a silly example, but if any of you watched the series Vikings that was on Amazon, has now moved to Netflix, you know, it's just an orgy of gratuitous violence, basically. But it gives you a window into a pre-Christian world, an honor culture in which power was exerted and maintained through the blunt use of force. And it is, you know, as a pastor, I sometimes look out on the world at large and see the way we're trashing our Christian heritage, but we do it without realizing what Christianity purchased for us, which was a profound experience of peace through the majority of our history, at least on this island. You read Tom Holland's book, The Historian, where he talks about his book Dominion, where he talks about the history of Christianity and the way that Christianity changed the world in ways that he hadn't seen as an atheist at one stage in his life. And this is what I'm speaking about. The teaching of Jesus gave you your moral impulses by which you want to critique toxic masculinity, because he was doing it long before the Guardian newspaper. The negative is that. But then there's the positive. I think Christianity offers men what they most need and desire. And let me just give you a few reasons why I say that. One is that just thinking back across the things I've said this evening, Christianity teaches men how to live well. I'm not saying that you have to be a Christian to do this, but I'm saying that this is what Christianity seeks to do. It gives, you know, when we're talking about men who are unable to engage meaningfully in the workforce, Christianity teaches the dignity of work as a service you offer to God, so that your day job, which you might find mundane and boring, suddenly is invested with profound purpose and dignity. It's an act of worship. Or when we think about education, it's not an accident that so much of the history of education sprung out of monasteries as the place of learning and the collection of libraries, and then how the movement to generalize education in Britain and offer schooling for everyone came out of churches and Christianity, because they're saying, you know, to quote one of the early church fathers, all truth is God's truth. And the desire to learn and understand the world in which we live is a theistic desire, because we assume that it has to be a rational, reasonable universe because God made it. There was a mind behind it. And that explains why so much of the history of science and learning and theology and mathematics and so much has sprung out of the soil of Christian truth. I know that we seem to have wanted to relegate that again, but it teaches us the dignity of learning, something that we're trying to instill in our four children. Work, education, family. Christianity teaches men to be responsible, to marry one woman and stay faithful to her for the rest of your life, and to be present in the lives of your children, to raise them up well. And I could go on, but I'm trying to help you to see how it puts within men a vision of what it means to be a man when we live in a culture in which there is a vacuum on that question. It also begins to heal men's most inward desires. You know, we talk about fatherlessness. Did you know that at the center of the Christian faith is the experience of God as Father? My own dad was, in the mid-1950s, was a child of a divorced home. It was very uncommon then. But his father had been abusive and his mother ran away with the three children. And he was 6 years of age, and it left deep scars in his life. And wasn't from a Christian home. And he carried those scars into adulthood, God began to radically turn his life around when he came to know Jesus, when he became a Christian. And I look back on the lineage of, you know, what's taken place in my own family history, and I see how a turning point took place in my dad's life when he came to know Jesus, and how it enabled him then to be the father that his dad never was, because he experienced the love of God, his father, in his life. And if we want an answer to the general problem of so many boys with this deep agony and insecurity and directionlessness and that ongoing adolescence, not knowing what it means to know the father, a father's love, the Christian faith offers something there. It speaks to those men who are lonely and isolated, an increasing problem, by putting them within a brotherhood or a tribe. It speaks to the guilty who are covered with shame. So many people hiding their real self out of shame, and begins to clean you up from the inside out and free you from self-destructive behavior as you walk in discipleship with Jesus and experience his forgiveness on your life. It helps people get out of the cycle of purposelessness and the despair that flows from that, and offers a place in the plan and mission of God to redeem and renew the whole earth. And to be quite frank with you, having seen so many people over the years come to know these truths in their own lives, I have witnessed the extraordinary 180-degree transforming effects of this truth in the lives of countless individuals. And I want to go a bit further and say this. I think Jesus can redeem masculinity itself. I will admit to you that if you were to put to me the question, what is masculinity? It's not an easy question to answer. But what we have at the center of the Christian faith is a man who is both God and man, but who offers to men a perfect example of manhood. So that in himself, and you can read the history books and you can scan the world for the best men that you and leaders all around us. Because it seems to me that when you look left and right and we scan the world, what we see is failure to the left and to the right. Scandal. But when people encountered Jesus, what they discovered in him was the extraordinary combination of qualities that drew them to him in adoration and worship, so that he somehow embodied within himself courage and authority with a tenderness and a sensitivity to human problems. He somehow could walk into, as he did into the temple precinct, and wield a whip against the evil money changers there who were cheating the people, but at the same time could pick up an adulterous woman from the floor and give her dignity in the face of a baying crowd that wanted to stone her and put her to death. And I've read many biographies. I've met thousands of people in the 15 years I've been a pastor. I've never met someone good in the way that Jesus is good. And the effect that he has on men is he gives them a vision of what it means to be a man. That's not a vacuum, but is personified in a person. You can see him. There is a wonderful psalm that describes the rule of King Jesus and ties together some of these paradoxes of the way he rules. He says, "May he have dominion from sea to sea and from the river to the ends of the earth." In other words, Jesus, the Christian vision is that Jesus is going to rule the entire earth, which might strike you as a strange claim, but I think I could substantiate it for another sort of life. But then it goes on and says, "He delivers the needy when he calls, the poor and him who has no helper. He has pity on the weak and the needy and saves the lives of the needy. From oppression and violence he redeems their life, and precious is their blood in his sight." It's this image of someone who has all authority in heaven and on earth and uses that authority to get down into the dirt and the mire and mess of our situation and heal us and bind us up. The way that we wish our rulers would today, instead of making rules that they themselves break, or earning extraordinary amounts of money and then taxing us to the hilt. You know, it's an extraordinary vision. And it is almost clearly demonstrated for us in the death of Jesus upon the cross. You see, some of his contemporaries saw this as the moment of abject weakness. And it offended the kind of right-wing populists and nationalists of his day. Here's someone who claims to be a ruler who's dying on the cross. He's useless. And others saw it as foolish. They thought, this is ridiculous, the idea that a man should die for us. We've got all these wonderful philosophies, and this was the Greeks, that offer us a much better, less bloody way of seeing our lives changed. And so it offended the left-wing liberal elites also. And the cross smashes through all of our polarized debates and offers you a vision of someone who has all authority in heaven and earth and uses that authority to die for your sins. And you cannot overestimate the way in which the vision of the crucified Savior who died for our sins transforms the Christian imagination and understanding of what it means to live the righteous life. That it's a life of service for others. That it can be fully, and for men, that it can be fully displaying what it means to have masculinity and manhood, but as a way of serving and even dying for others. And he invites any man who is struggling with a lack of sense of who they are, with lack of purpose, with a lack of meaning, with a lack of hope, to encounter him there in his death for you on the cross. Thus endeth the talk. I'm going to pass on back to Jeremy.
Okay, so anyway, now the moment you've been waiting for, we're going to put Andrew under the microscope. I think, honestly, if you were dreading, I think it's fair to say there were part of you that was kind of dreading giving the talk. I think there's a good part of you that was also dreading answering the questions. Is that fair?
Well, it's always the questions, you know. You don't know what's going to happen, do you? So
I want to know more about your ornamental sign of manhood here, this beard. Although I'm pretty
sure... You've got a nice starter kit going on yourself.
I'm pretty sure you started the beard long before Dreams of Masculinity, but to address an absence here... Okay, we're going to stop insulting each other. It's our friendship. Okay, so let's start with a few here, and we'll quickly go to the floor. So first of all, you mentioned about passivity of men, or I think you did, because this person's asking about it, and they're saying, how is passivity of men seen in the current culture? What evidence do you have of passivity in our current culture among men? I think it's kind of when you're talking about the idea of soft men.
Yeah, I think there are so many examples that jump to mind, but let me, perhaps one of the ones that I think is most close to home is the reticence within men to get married, early, and to have children, because the whole picture of a married man raising his children is one of the diminishment of personal autonomy on the altar of service to others. And I think that is, there are many other examples of this, but for me, I think that's the most, perhaps the most obvious example of the way in which men are increasingly reluctant to assume responsibility. And it creates frustration across the board. We did a whole evening on the issue of sex and dating for one of the Salt Life talks a few years ago, long before lockdown, and you're welcome to go back and listen to that. But it's something that I addressed in much more depth then and would want to point you back to that. But I think it's probably, for me, that's like putting my finger on the pulse of where men are at today is in that particular area, because it's so personal and it's so unique to the modern age as well, and particularly to the Western secular age.
Yeah, and we've seen it in our community. A number of women who would say, like, where are the men stepping forward
absolutely.
In this area? Okay, you said Jesus is the perfect man or the perfect vision of manhood, but what then of women? Are they called to be like him too? Does the example of authority and tenderness not apply to women too?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think the reality is that men and women will... There'll be a lot of overlap in the way that you experience and relate to Jesus and to God as Father, but there will also be difference. And there are Christians, and I don't particularly have much affinity with this thinking, but there are Christians who kind of want to play down the reality of Christ's maleness and his masculinity, as because they want to kind of bend him to the androgynous reality of the modern age, and perhaps even... We haven't helped ourselves by often portraying him visually as this kind of feminine figure with pale skin and long blonde hair and blue eyes and all that, and a far cry from the kind of hardworking builder that he actually was, who was both, you know, skilled and learned and all those kinds of things. But yeah, absolutely, I think the Christian faith offers extraordinary dignifying it gives hope to women in much the same ways, but it would be a different talk. I would need to kind of go into much more length about that. But I think women do obviously find in their relationship to Jesus that they want to emulate his character in very similar ways. But it takes on a different slant or a different flavor if you are a man or a woman, because I think we are different in certain respects.
That's really helpful. Some people would say this event seems a bit kind of counterintuitive because men have seemingly vacated the church. The irony is that churches often are more female-dominated than male. So this person was asking, why do you think that men have seemingly vacated the church? I mean, almost you might say, if we're saying there's a crisis of masculinity, does the church have a male problem?
Yes, it does, absolutely. I don't want to speak about this at too much length because I don't want to speak only to the Christians in the room, obviously. But there are significant challenges facing the church, I think globally, particularly in the Western world, where men are less interested in matters of faith. And I think it's not helped by the way that the church has become quite cowardly, especially in Britain, and unwilling to speak the truth as we've been called to across the centuries. You know, our own archbishop used his Easter sermon to speak about some political issues and not to announce the death and resurrection of Jesus with the complete forthright, you know, as is his calling, and that frustrates me. And I think it's kind of endemic within the church that she's trying to, that the church is almost trying to please and conform to the culture too much. And it seems to be alienating to men. And I think in my observation, and I could be wrong and I'm open to contradiction on this, I think men are more charged by and drawn to a truly countercultural church. And tragically, the church in Britain has long since, I'm speaking in very general terms, long since forgotten her calling, and hence why churches across the nation are largely empty, with, you know, wonderful exceptions, but largely that's the case. And I think Christianity hasn't for a long time offered men a compelling vision of what it means, and what it means to lay down your life, what it means to, in Jesus' own words, to die to yourself, and to the sacrifice that's involved, and the rigor of obedience, and even violence against, you know, as Paul said, I beat my flesh in order that I might attain the prize. And the kind of those elements of the Christian faith have for a long time been sort of watered down and muddied and somewhat obscured. And therefore, yeah, across the board, there's a massive problem, I think. And it troubles me immensely.
Well, I think it'd be great. We've got more here, but I'd love to hear from some people from the floor. And I just want to encourage you that this is an open dialogue. We'd love to hear if you disagree with anything you've heard, or, you know, whatever. Basically, you know, maybe you came here tonight very secular, not Christian at all, and you think this, I just don't get much of what you're saying. We'd love to hear your questions and thoughts. So, just all I say is when we get past the microphone to you, Zach's gonna keep hold of the microphone, and if you can keep your question relatively short so we can get through quite a few, that would be great. Okay, I think is it Bob? Yeah, go on.
Hi, thank you. That was a great talk. Both G.K. Chesterton and C.S. Lewis spoke in laudable terms of the chivalric code and of virtue ethics. What role do you think that those two codes play in rediscovering a masculinity discipled by Christ?
So what was the first word? The what code?
The chivalric code.
Oh, chivalry. Yeah, okay. I don't think I'm going to be able to give you a particularly intelligent answer on this. I would say that I think historically, visions of, you know, because Christianity was so deeply entwined with our cultural history, visions of what it meant to be a chivalrous man, and what it meant, you know, in more recent language, what it meant to be a gentleman, were in many ways conformed to Christian ideals and were shaped by them. They didn't exactly overlap, but they were also ways of trying to help men control their impulses. And I think we have done a disservice in our modern age by reacting against, you know, as an example, the idea of it being a gentleman is now almost an offensive concept because it's seen as something that's patronizing or paternalistic over women. But the result is that men then don't have a positive vision of what they're meant to be and the way in which they're meant to then control their impulses. And, you know, the Bible is replete with descriptions and portrayals of what righteousness is, what it means to conform to an image of righteousness. And because we are mimetic creatures, which is to say that we learn through imitation. You know, I've watched this time and time again with each of my kids, that there is a lot of the learning just comes through imitation. If we have positive visions of what it means to be a man, men are more likely to conform to it. In the absence of those, or the denigration of those, or the rubbishing of those, we're left, as I said earlier, with something of a vacuum. And I think that the image of a good man, whether that's chivalry, whether that's gentlemanliness, whatever it is, does always need to be adjusted, of course, with each age, and needs to, in my perspective, needs to conform more and more to Scripture and to Jesus. But I know that not everyone here is going to want to agree with that. Even though it adjusts with each age, I think just the doing away with it entirely has been a real problem and explains a lot of the mess we see around us.
Great. Who's next? Yeah, one over here, Zach. We're just going to keep throwing around each side of the room, if that's good. He's very fit, believe it or not. I mean...
I'd say in the Christian faith and in general in how we treat each other, empathy is important. But part of that is, I'd say, being willing to show some level of emotional vulnerability to open up to others. How would you say that fits in with masculinity?
That's a great question.
I'm not sure I thought through how I wanted
to
word the question.
It's perfectly clear, yeah. How does emotional vulnerability fit in with masculinity? I'd like to hear your thoughts as someone who is more naturally emotionally vulnerable than I am.
And Andrew naturally is about as emotionally vulnerable as a stone.
Yes. No, you get me on the wrong day. I mean, Jeremy's heard me blub. He's seen every side of my emotion. I think, let me just quickly offer a quick answer, and I would be interested in throwing this over to you. Yes, I think when we talk about one of the frustrations, I think that has bubbled up, has been this idea that a man has to conform to this stoic image of strength and non-emotional ideal that actually has been profoundly damaging. It led to fathers who were not affectionate with their children or with their wives. It's led to men suffering internally and not being able to deal with that. It's led to all kinds of negative consequences. And actually, I think that traces its roots more back to Greek philosophy than it does to Christianity or indeed the Hebrew heritage in Scripture. In Greek philosophy, there were ways. I mean, the fact is we're born into a world of suffering. And the philosophers were trying to ask the question, how do we cope? How do we deal with a world of suffering? And, you know, you can go to Buddhism, and Buddhism would teach you to be detached from this world so that suffering can't gain a purchase on your life, but neither then can necessarily joy or happiness. And similarly, the Greek philosophers, and particularly the Stoics, taught this is something similar to detachment, and it's kind of experiencing something of a revival in our day and age, probably because people are feeling more fragile than ever, and we need answers. But I don't think that particularly the English, I'm specifying English as opposed to Scottish or Welsh, the Celtic lands with all their passionate, fiery emotion, the English were particularly guilty of perpetuating this emotionless ideal of a man. And it really has very little relationship with anything that I can see in the Bible. You only need to, if you crack a Bible open right in the middle, you land in a songbook called the Psalms. And the Psalms, most of them were written by King David, who was the great, 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 plus, plus, plus grandfather of Jesus. And viewed as Israel's greatest king. partly because of his warrior spirit. You know, he slew Goliath, he extended the kingdom. There were all kinds of things which commended him as a king in terms of bringing justice and order and rule to his nation. But in the Psalms, you see his emotions laid bare. And this was not a private book. It was obviously became a songbook for the Israelites. And there is not an emotion that humans experience that isn't fully explored in the Psalms in the middle of the Bible. And therefore, the Christian heritage is not one of emotionless masculinity, but rather one of vulnerability. And I will add this. I think that because the heart of the Christian message is not this idea that you have to perform and work your way to God, but rather that he has come to us in our weakness and our frailty, it allows us, and I'm speaking specifically to men who may find this particularly difficult, to bear the reality of our mess, because we're not trying to earn God's love, but rather God comes to us. And I think that the center of the Christian faith, therefore, is a willingness to be real and let God fix you, let God heal you, let him mend you, and not just fake it or pretend or, in fact, lie to others and to God.
That's brilliant. I think I'd only echo that and say the great enemy of emotional vulnerability is fear, and really the fear of what other people will think of me. And that is a besetting challenge for so many in our culture in all sorts of ways. And I think in men, it often then leads to a lack of emotional vulnerability, which is destructive in and of itself, because it's the emotional vulnerability is so essential to healthy relationships, which are part of flourishing humanity. So the Christian worldview says we are made as relational beings and we need each other. I mean, it's part of why I enjoy, actually, is when we're speaking, that people do see that we have a really good friendship as well as a working relationship as pastors, is because we are literally experiencing the benefit and joy of those relationships as part of our work as leading a church. So we need each other, and therefore we need to be emotional vulnerability, and therefore we need to overcome the fear of what other people think of us. And the only way we can overcome the fear of what other people think of us is by that idea that Andrew mentioned, which is that the very center of the Christian faith is the posture of God towards you. That because he loves you, because he was willing to send his son to die for you, that essentially, because you are already loved, you do not need to worry what other people think of you. And that is the great releasing truth at the center of the Christian faith. That means as you embrace the person of Christ and as you embrace the love that he has for you, you are released from this great fear, which is like shackles around you, controlling your opinions and controlling the person, the way you present yourself towards others. You're released from that fear and you can actually love others and be vulnerable and allow people to make jokes about your physical appearance or whatever else it is that Andrew so graciously allowed me to do this evening, because you're no longer worried what other people think of you. And that, of course, is a lifelong journey for any Christian, but it is at the center of the promise of the Christian faith, is encounter a love that gives you true freedom. Go on. We've got one more here, and then we'll come here. Gentleman with a nice, slightly Hawaiian shirt, I don't want to say.
More like a slight disagreement than question. I often like meet in Christian circles, and you said like, oh, you know, these days the prison population is like, you know, full of men, and the Me Too movement, it couldn't have happened, you know, back in the day. And like I often hear like, oh, you know, back in the day men were men, and you know, it was perfect, and it's a new problem. But like, you know, even the so-called Christian Europe that you mentioned, you know, there were wars ever so often where men legally could like leave out their aggression in war, you know, kill whoever they wanted, rape whoever they wanted. So isn't it just a case that you know, it's not a new problem, it's just has new aspect of it, but I just like often feel like it says like, oh, back in the day everything was fine, and it's just new, it's 21st century liberal thing.
So you're kind of saying, are you kind of arguing a traditionalism here? Are you arguing a hark back to the past? Because actually, look at the past, look at this Christian past that you might present, where actually there were wars and rapes and all sorts of things that were done which were deeply broken. And you're saying, are you arguing for tradition? Actually, tradition was, look at the past, it's not positive. Is that what you're saying?
No, absolutely not. I mean, I partly disagree with the premise when you say that in our Christian history, men could kill whoever they want, rape whoever they want. I don't think that's true. And I think obviously there have been dark patches in the history over the last, you know, since Christianity hit the British Isles about 1600 years ago, there have been moments of increased justice and decreased justice, so I can acknowledge that. But also you've seen a progressive impact of the rule of law and a yearning towards justice. That's the way Tom Holland described it, was that the Christian faith, for many of the things that we now take for granted in our day, like the concepts like equality, human rights, and he lists up, every chapter is based on a different angle of what Christianity offered the world. And it wasn't that everything happened overnight, because we're dealing with flawed people. You know, I love Jesus, but I'm by no means perfect. And, you know, there is a progressive aspect in the case of the individual to becoming more like Jesus. But I think it's also true in communities, perhaps even in nations. And therefore, wherever you see that there's kind of regressive moments in history where Christians have done evil things, you know, and there are a number of ways you can tackle that. One is, you know, were they really Christian? I mean, you know, doing stuff in the name of Jesus doesn't mean that Jesus endorses it. And but also just aside, for me, it's very important to acknowledge that there is this constant reforming that's taking place in history. And there are moments I can point to in history where there was a recovery of the gospel. You know, the 1500s, it happened with the Protestant Reformation. The 1700s, it happened with the preaching of John Wesley and George Whitefield across the nation. And at those moments when eyes and attention were drawn back to the Bible and to Jesus, and people were no longer content with just nominalism, which is saying you're a Christian but not living like it, when we were drawn back to it, suddenly transformation took place. But but as with every religion, nominalism is the enemy. The idea that you can bear the name of Christian without actually having any relationship with Jesus. And whenever that has been the dominant reality, unfortunately, there has been many things that so-called Christians have done that is wrong.
And I think I'd just add that many of you might have experienced nominalism as the only form of Christianity that you've encountered.
Yeah.
AKA, basically, for the last 100 years in British history, which many of us have experienced, you will have encountered a great deal of nominalism, where basically people went to church on Sundays, but actually it had no impact on their lives. And so, I'm going to misphrase, so you can probably get this better, but an author, which was mentioned over there, G.K. Chesterton, said something like, Christianity's not been tried and found wanting, it's just not been tried at all. You want to do it properly?
It's not been tried and found wanting, but it's been... I've forgotten it too.
Essentially,
something like
essentially,
it's too hard. That's what
our culture has often not actually embraced what we might describe as full-blooded, authentic, genuine discipleship, genuinely becoming a disciple of the person of Christ. So when we look at throughout history, Christian history, we see littered examples of people who had a superficial connection at best with this doctrine, and actually it had no impact on their lives, to which we say, actually, Christ would not look on that and say, that's mine. So Christ calls men and women to a full-blooded embrace of his life and to follow him in every part of their lives. Yeah. And so that kind of may well have been missing in the periods when people said...
It wasn't so long ago, was it, that there was a major world leader claiming to be a Bible-loving Christian. And when asked what was his favourite verse in the Bible, he said, well, I love the whole Bible, you know. couldn't think of a verse, think... Seriously. Anyone can make any kind of claim. I mean, that's easy to do.
It's great.
It just kind of proves my point, though, you know. So.
I believe Mr. Putin is making similar kind of claims.
Yeah, precisely. Yeah.
Next person. I promised this guy at the front. Where's Zach gone? Thank you. Thank you, Zach.
Thanks, Zach. Andrew, right?
Yes.
Yeah, so I wanted to... my question was twofold. First of all, what do you think, in terms of... If we bring it to masculinity and femininity within race relationships, obviously, for yourself, it seems like you portray more of a traditional Christian type of masculinity, and in terms of submission and everything else that you speak of, I guess your wife is there as well... Asian as well. I wanted to ask, in terms of how you feel about submission, how do you think a man should portray himself in terms of masculinity to not be, obviously, you know, get the balance right between masculinity and vulnerability in terms of emotionality or simping in that sense? Because obviously, some in light of recent pundits, there is a risk of being emotionally vulnerable and pandering to females to be perceived as simping. And I guess simping, if I was to define it for you, in terms of being a bit too acquiescent to your female counterpart and allowing her to lead you instead of you leading her. So in terms of getting the balance right, how do you perceive that in terms of being a man who a woman would want to follow naturally without having to impose yourself as a leader? And secondly, in terms of...
you've given us a lot there.
I'm not sure how the race part comes into
Churches encourage that, basically.
So I wasn't clear. So you're basically asking about the dynamics within marriage, are you, of men and women? And
marriage and courtship.
Yeah. Marriage and courtship. But where does the race part come into it?
So race, is from what a lot of commentators have said, that obviously traditionally in the West... females tend to be more, I guess they haven't got the word submission has become more of a dirty word in the sense of whereas in the East and obviously Africa and places like that, it's more natural. You get more of a traditional concept of a biblical kind of femininity in terms of not wanting to be equal, leading, but more in terms of following that kind of godly leader.
Yeah, okay.
Great, thank you.
Yeah, I mean, it's obviously the case that through most cultures in history, there has been a kind of patriarchal assumption in the sense that the men were considered the head of their home and women are called to submit. But then as soon as you scratch beneath the surface, you discover a lot of problems, right? So... Now, my wife, yeah, you correctly identify that she's Southeast Asian, but actually born and bred here. So, but I have therefore had the interesting experience of spending time in and around the culture from which her family has come. And it's been an interesting thing that although there are these kind of, there's the performance of headship submission within marriages, very often the reality is that is much more complex and much more... These things are rarely simple, and it's not the case that you can just sort of say, oh, well, the whole world has assumed a kind of patriarchal structure except the West. Very often there are ways, and I've seen in my wife's family, where women were definitely in charge, I'll tell you that, and clearly. And let me try and say something productive here. When the Bible speaks into these issues, and obviously there are some key passages in the New Testament, which is the most recent part of the Bible, written after the coming of Jesus, the authors were writing into cultures that did assume male headship in the home, but writing into cultures where men were almost like gods in their own homes. And they could do whatever they want, and they could abuse, and they could oppress. And that was certainly true across the Roman world. And, you know, we've seen examples of that in the modern iterations in cultures today. And the way that the scripture speaks into this is it doesn't totally destroy or dismantle the structure, but it completely redefines it. So when Paul, the Apostle Paul, or Saint Paul, you may have heard of him as that, speaks to men as husbands, he absolutely affirms their call to be spiritual heads in their homes and to lead their homes. But the way in which they are to practice the leadership in their home is through the lens of what I told you about Jesus, how he says, if you want to be great, you've got to be the servant of all. So he tells husbands to act like Jesus, and he said, just as Jesus died for his bride, the church, so also husbands lay down their lives effectively for their wives. And that was nothing short of revolutionary, even at the time that Paul wrote it. And it laid the seeds for the redefinition of how husbands and wives should interact, how it gave wives power and a voice and an agency within the home, and helped sort of limit the sovereignty and lordship of husbands to abuse and all those kinds of things, and began to turn everything upside down. So even though you might think on the face of it, Christianity agrees with so much of the kind of the wider world, shall we say, apart from the West, actually, I think once you get into the detail, you quickly discover that Christianity wants, the teaching of the Bible wants to kind of reform how husbands and wives, not to completely undo that structure, but to so inform it with a new way of relating that it doesn't feel in any way like the oppressive reality that many have known through history. So that's a short answer.
It's amazing listening to you when you talk about that, that the way that it strikes me that Christ is this incredible paradox of courage, strength, and authority, i.e. one who says, I am the Lord of all, I am the King of the universe, obey me and surrender rightly to my authority, and strength, willingness to defy his critics and to tell them. At one point, to some religious leaders, he says, you're like the children of Satan. He speaks directly to those in power and challenges them with incredible strength. And yet his willingness to lay down his life and sacrifice himself, and that willingness to die, that willingness to surrender everything and to be humiliated naked on a cross. Here, the most powerful man who ever lived, effectively, who claims both to be man and God, is willing to surrender his life naked, humiliated on a tree. And that is incredible. That paradox means that no Christian who wants to follow Christ and exercise some level of authority can ever exercise authority in a oppressive and destructive way for the sake of those they are leading, whether it be church leaders or a husband leading his family or whatever it is. A Christian who is called to leadership is called to sacrificial death, is called to lay down their life. And that is the most beautiful form of leadership. It redeems leadership. It says there is such a thing as authority, there is such a thing as good leadership, but it is the most beautiful leadership you've ever seen. Yeah. And just as actually, when you see this idea of marriage, of a husband laying down his life for his wife, when you see that, that's beautiful. When you see a husband, a father willing to lay down his time and spend time with his children and willing invest himself there, or we see a leader willing to give up his privileges for the sake of those he's leading, that's beautiful. That is because Christ is beautiful. And you are seeing the beauty of Christ in that. So I think it's really got to be seen as well as intellectualized, if that makes sense. You've got to see the beauty here. I feel like we have time for one more question. I mean, I like to run over time on any event that I lead. It's already 9:30. There's lots of you here. I was going to take one here, I'm afraid. What do you think? You think I should... No, I want to go with this one. Do you agree with me? Just one question, though. Okay, good. Okay. Genuinely, I think this one is the most important question to ask. If you're a man with feelings of despair, resentment, or emotional turmoil, so I suspect there'll be some in the room here today where this is not just a lovely intellectual idea, but this is genuinely very sincerely felt. Some of the issues you mentioned, whether it be suicide or despair, sense of resentment, or just emotional turmoil, like, how do you go about addressing that? Almost like, how do you take some of what we've talked about, very theoretical and broad general terms, and make it a very personal response here?
I think, look, if a house is on fire, you want to put out the fire before you begin to reform and rebuild the house. And I would say, if there is someone here, maybe you wrote the question, and that is your situation. Like, if you're in the pit of despair, you're really in a dark place. There are immediate things you have to do, and then there are long-term things you have to do. And immediately, the most important thing to do is to speak to someone, and ideally to a professional who can offer you that help, which can just put out the fire and help you just suddenly find purchase in your life where you can have hope. But it won't fix you long term unless you begin to do the rebuilding work and the recladding and whatever else, you know, to extend the metaphor. And my sense is that that despair and those sense of, you know, the hopelessness will resurface in people if they don't begin to relay foundations. Jesus used the analogy when he talked about building your life. He said some people build their life on, is like a house built on sand, and some people's life is like a house built on rock. And he said a house built on sand, when the wind comes and the rains fall, it falls down. But he said people who build their life on my word are like a house built on rock. They're robust. I saw an image this week a gif of a house in North Carolina with stilts that went into the sand. And of course, North Carolina gets hurricanes just about twice a year. And of course, the thing had just collapsed into the sand. It was a living parable of what Jesus had said. And to me, that's the long-term work of rebuilding a life requires that dedication to devotion to Christ and to his word that can reform you from the inside out and give you that hope and rigidity and strength that will turn your life around completely. But I don't want to just say, okay, that's going to happen immediately. And I think if you are in a dark place, I would urge you to come and speak to someone who you know can help.
Yeah, that's really helpful. I would just add on the question of hope, I think a lot of what I feel like Christianity is almost the reintroduction of hope. We live in a relatively hopeless world where most of us might have put our hope in all sorts of human solutions or human philosophies or the hope of technology or whatever it is. And effectively, those hopes have been dashed against the rocks of reality, where we've seen leaders fail, philosophies fail, personalities fail. And we're kind of searching, saying, what will give us hope? And particularly hope in the face of the enemy of death, ultimately. And into that reality of despair and the felt sense of despair, I think, which our culture can attest to, effectively, the Bible says, a light has dawned, effectively. In the context of darkness, a light has dawned, which gives great hope to the people. And basically, that hope is in a person, in Jesus Christ. Yeah. And essentially, it says, the end is no longer death, that those who believe in him will experience a resurrection when he comes back, that they will experience life with him. There's a day coming when there is no more death, where the world is filled with his love. And it sounds a little bit too good to be true, that a world where there's no brokenness, no sin, no destruction, a world of no suffering, a world of filled with love. But it is that hope built in the historical reality of this person who lived and died and rose again. It is that hope built on a historical truth that has gripped the heart of any Christian here. That is basically, I didn't come from a Christian family, I come from a Jewish atheist family, and yet this hope, that there is hope for the world, that humanity can experience life after death, and not just that, but a reformation, a transformation of the heart, that there is love is possible in a world which is full of hate and selfishness. Mm. That hope gripped my heart about 12, 14 years ago, and it's transformed everything. And I just say, if you're here thinking, what is this, and this all just feels a little bit too good to be true, I'd say, possibly it is, or possibly it's true, and hope exists, and there is a love at the center of the universe that made you for himself. That is God who made you for himself, and he wants to be in relationship with you. He loves you, and he even loves you so much he was willing to send his son to die for you. And so I would just pause on the sense of this is just too good to be true and say, this is worth your time. This is worth you investigating. This is, for me, it was worth me putting down my kind of resistance and to investigate and say, is this true? And if it is true, what does this mean? And I would just urge you, whether it's something like the Salt Course or another avenue, going online, or even just reading a gospel, reading one of the accounts of Jesus' life, Mark's gospel, take you about an hour and a half, 2 hours. I believe you will, when you come face to face with the person of Jesus Christ, you will see the reality of the beauty and the majesty and the love and the glory that we've just hinted at, that is worth your time. So if I can never talk to you again, let me suggest that for you. Guys, why don't we give Andrew a massive round of applause.